The game we're doing here is I have on my phone 14 titles of think pieces about Love Actually. Six of them I have made up. Eight of them are real.
All right, so we're going to go through all 14?
And then after every one, you guys have to guess what you think it is, and I will tell you what the actual answer is, and then we will tally up and see who wins.
Okay. Okay.
All right, so the first one is a love letter to Love Actually.
I think that's fake.
Fake.
That is real.
What?
Number two is Hate Actually.
That's real.
That is real.
Yeah.
You are correct. Number three is, I've come here with a view of asking you to marriage me, the language of Love Actually.
Fake.
Fake.
You are correct. That
Yay!
Is fake. Good job.
That was really good, though.
Thank you.
I was for a moment like, ooh, that could conceivably, yeah.
Yeah.
Number four is Loathe Actually.
What? Real.
I hope it's real.
It's fake. Number five is Love Actually Doesn't Exist.
Fake.
Real.
It is real.
Ah!
Damn it!
Number six. Love Actually isn't a romantic comedy or a Christmas movie. It's a tragedy.
Real.
Real.
It is real.
Yeah.
Number seven. Love Actually, still awful.
Real.
It is.
Yeah!
Number eight. Our special relationship. What the PM's speech would actually do to US-UK relations.
Fake.
Fake!
It is fake, but I wish it was real.
Me too! Oh, Brendan.
Because we don't
know.
As we discussed, there's no real politics.
No, we don't know what they're talking about.
Well, it's a lot of talks about politics without any politics in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number nine. The gender roles in Love Actually are problematic because men hold most of the power.
Real.
Fake.
That is real.
Oh, well, I'm glad it's real.
Yes! Caught up.
Number ten. The lobster in the nativity play represents everything wrong with Love Actually.
Real.
Fake.
Fake.
I reign supreme.
Oh, damn it. You know, that
sounds like something you would write.
I know, it does. I'm worried that a lot of the fake ones sound too much like something I would actually write.
But that's almost more confusing because I feel like...
That one was close.
That also means something a writer would go for
too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. 11. Well, actually, an exploration of toxic masculinity in Love Actually.
Fake.
Real.
That is fake.
Ah!
That was my favorite one that I came up with.
Oh,
that was,
great.
The first one I jotted down.
Oh, Brendan, that was inspired.
Fuck, that's really good.
I would, by the way,
written that.
I would fucking click that article. I would love.
12. What killed the rom-com? It was Love, actually.
Real.
Real.
That is real.
Woo! All right, we're really down to the bone.
All right, number 13.
Yeah.
When I get gloomy with the state of the world, it's because I'm watching Love Actually.
I think I've read that one. I think that's real. I'm going
to
say real.
When you get gloomy with the state of the world.
Whenever I get gloomy with the state of the world, it's because I'm watching Love Actually.
Real.
That is fake.
Ah, fuck.
Okay, the last one.
Mm-hmm. For all the marbles.
Yeah. Why you should actually love Actually.
Oh, God.
Real.
I'm going to say it's real.
That is real.
Woo!
Do we have a winner?
Is that a dead tie?
I have 9 right.
I have 7 right.
Lee, well done.
Woo!
Thank you to Sean Patrick for suggesting that we do this.
I think peace.
Thank you, Sean Patrick. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that was really great. Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. Also, well done to you, Brendan, for coming up with those things.
Thank you.
Well, actually, it was so fucking...
That really is,
I
love that so much.
Mwah. How is that not a think piece?
I don't know.
That is AV Club written all over it.
Yes.
Very special Christmas episode of Why Did You Watch This? This is your host for this week, Lee. It's not funny. It's Art Delahanty.
I'm Brendan, chock-a-block full of condoms, Drishler.
And I'm Chris, alone under the mistletoe, Ravel.
And as stated before, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, this is the big one, big Christmas episode. This is when we finally sit down and tackle everyone's favorite slash least favorite slash problematic Christmas rom-com, Love Actually.
Problematic fave.
Do we do drinks or movie synopsis first?
Let's do the drinks.
Let's talk about the drinks. We had two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first one.
They were great.
I loved, and I had two of.
That's right. The first one was called a Nativity Lobster,
mm-hmm.
and that was sparkling rosé wine, stout beer, ground espresso, and an orange twist garnish. You fill a flute about three quarters of the way with the rosé, and then you top it with stout beer and garnish with a little bit of ground espresso and an orange twist.
Yep, it was fucking delicious.
Yeah, it was great.
I didn't like it.
Brendan had a sip of his, and then I drank the rest of it.
I had three sips, because I wanted to make sure that I didn't like it.
Well, it's so similar to then with the second drink. It was the same thing for Lee.
Oh, second drink, let's talk about it. Love is mulled around.
Love actually is mulled around, which is apple cider, dry red wine, maple syrup, black peppercorns, an orange sliced, and an apple sliced, and we threw them all in a crock pot and simmered for a while.
What must have been it?
I don't know. I think it was either the apple cider or the maple syrup that did me in.
It might have been the syrup. The syrup added a different flavor.
It had such a sweet, to my senses, smell that I was just so on. The smell
really, I really liked it.
I did too. I was worried initially that, like, I was looking for mulled cider recipes, and this one had wine in it, which I thought was weird.
Yeah.
Because I was worried that it would just taste like mulled wine again. Yeah. But it really did not. It tasted very apple-y, and I really think it was the maple syrup that made it taste the way it did. And whether or not that's something you will like will depend very much on your taste.
We've really hit the whole spectrum, though, because I was digging both of them, but you guys each had a favorite.
Chris was happy.
I was very
happy and unhappy, depending on what time it was.
I soaked up everyone's extras.
I very much enjoyed the first drink. It was my type of drink. It's got some wine. It's got sparkling wine and stout beer, which are two things I love.
Yeah.
Chris had said maybe if it was a darker stout or a chocolate
stout.
Really didn't prepare the stout, really. We just kind of had an extra.
I think maybe if it was one of those two, I might have liked it more.
Although, to be fair, I thought a brown sugar stout would be okay. But I think if we're going to really get at the kind of chocolatiness to make it more of a red velvet flavor,
we
it would have
been. Milk. Left hand milk chocolate stout.
Which is delicious.
Let's try this again. Let's reconvene in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And we'll try that again. Although,
for the mini.
Yeah.
Let's get shittier rosé this time.
It was good, though.
Yeah, it was good rosé. But I'm not, like, I had really resented having to go to a liquor store and buy a sparkling rosé as a woman. I hated
it. You felt like it was, like, fulfilling a stereotype?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Or a prophecy.
Well, by the way,
a dark prophecy.
If it's any of the three of us, it's inescapable. What we need to do is get a straight male friend to do it. Because if it's a woman, of course. If it's a gay man, of course.
Yeah.
So we need to, like, put Sean Patrick up to it. Like, buy us some sparkling rosé.
Please buy me some sparkling rosé, because I can't do it. We're going to talk about this movie, and we're not going to read a goddamn Wikipedia synopsis, because if you guys haven't seen Love Actually, I don't know what to fucking tell you at this point in your life.
Yeah. Honestly, if you haven't seen it, I don't understand how you haven't absorbed its plot through cultural osmosis.
It's
everywhere.
It is a movie that your friends have definitely shown you at one point. You know even if you have not seeked it out.
Maybe if it was even on in the background of, like, a holiday party you went to in someone's college dorm, you have a familiarity with this movie.
Do you guys remember how there was a YouTube video of some woman who'd never seen Star Wars, and she was trying to explain what she thought Star Wars was. I would love to see that for Love Actually. Listen, I've got eight fucking bullet points of different characters and stories in this movie.
Yeah.
So we're gonna go through them real quick. We're just gonna give you a one sentence log line, because that's all you're gonna need to remember. It's all gonna come flooding back to you now. I've written them down in a sort of like my own personal preference. We've got David the PM, played by Hugh Grant.
Yes.
And Natalie, played by, I don't know.
Martine McCutcheon.
Sure, that sounds good.
Yep.
Good. Checks out.
So you've got the PM who's got this new, he's the new PM, and he has like a house staff, and amongst them is this sort of maid / secretary. Unclear.
She seems to be.
She brings
like,
him tea, but also papers.
Yeah. She seems to be like the intern.
I guess.
Yeah, she's part of the household staff.
She's part of the household staff.
Because they already have a housekeeper, and they already have the weird, like,
British man.
So
who else could you possibly
But then
need?
There's, like, the head of staff woman.
She's probably the president has a secretary pool. I'm sure that she's in that pool.
Sure. She brings him coffee, tea, biscuits,
and then
the occasional forms.
Yeah. And he instantly sort of has a crush on her and doesn't know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Jamie and Aurelia. Jamie being a writer who instantly finds out at the start of this movie that his girlfriend has been cheating on him.
I thought it was his girlfriend.
I don't think he's married.
I don't think they're married.
Oh, okay, never
That's
mind.
Too deep.
Yeah, they don't show, like, the divorce procedure.
Yeah. So his brother's been screwing his girlfriend, basically. And so he runs off to the French countryside to do a retreat, which he was supposed to do with his wife, which seems weird if he went there to write, but besides the point. And while he's there, the chateau or whatever he's renting...
The cottage is being looked after
by a Portuguese housemaid, and they don't speak each other's language. But they feel an attraction.
Yes. Well, and hilariously, they're both saying the same thing.
Yeah, they are finishing sentences a lot.
Sort of like, yeah, they're sort of talking in their own languages, but responding unknowingly to each other's.
Yeah.
I hope there's not eels in here. Try not to disturb the eels.
Yeah. Good shit.
Yeah.
We've got Daniel, played by Liam Neeson. Sam, played by an elfin changeling child.
Joachim Reed.
Yeah, that guy. The guy that plays the Reed child, children of Game of Thrones.
Joachim Reed from Game of Thrones.
Firstborn of Oberon, Fairy King.
Yeah.
And Joanna, his childhood is
crush.
Crush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who shares a name with his dead mother.
Yep.
Joachim
so Daniel,
Reed's dead mother.
Daniel married into this woman's sort of family, and she has this kid, so he's the stepfather.
Right.
The wife had probably cancer and died.
Yeah.
Leaving him unexpectedly to raise this, you know, 10-ish-year-old boy of his own. And the boy, instead of being consumed by grief at his mother's death, is just in love with another 10-year-old girl. And so they bond by helping him win the heart of this 10-year-old girl,
yeah.
Joanna. We got Peter, Mark, and Juliet. This is a contentious one.
we'll get to it.
So Peter has married Juliet. Peter's best friend is Mark,
right.
Who appears distant to Juliet. However, it is revealed halfway through that he is actually secretly in love with Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
As
evidenced by all the videotape he was taking.
Yeah, sort
over.
Of like filmed the wedding, but only filmed really close-ups of her.
Whoops. Like tight, unforgiving close-ups too.
Unforgiving. And so she finds out because she's watching this tape, and he has to sort of like come out with it. And so he does it through this bizarre grand gesture with cue cards that we all know and love / hate. you've got Billy Mack and the manager.
Yeah,
yeah.
Billy Mack being a sort of
washed up
rock star, used to be a big deal. Now he's trying to sell out and make a Christmas album for
a number one.
Yeah, like a number one Christmas single.
He's a little sleazy. He sort of has this like rakish charm. He's kind of saying,
"It's Bill Nye."
Yeah,
it's Bill Nye.
Yeah.
And his manager, who is similarly like, you imagine that probably Billy Mack is his only client.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does seem that way.
Yeah. And so they sort of come to realize, or Billy Mack comes to realize and confesses to his manager that after all the years he's been through and all the like ups and downs of his life, the manager is sort of the only person that he could claim as like someone he loves in any sense. You've got Karen, Mia, and Harry. So Karen,
oh,
played by
God.
Emma Thompson.
Yeah. She's so fucking fat.
So dowdy.
Disgusting to look at.
Mary's just heap clothing upon her.
She has
her.
The largest sweater I've ever seen, I think.
She's married to Harry, played by Alan Rickman, some sort of unidentified business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where Laura Linney also works.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
They've got a new secretary named Mia,
mm-hmm.
who has been specifically hired to fuck Alan Rickman.
Yeah,
pretty much.
She's a Bratz doll brought to life, and her one mission is to bed Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
And that's all she wants.
And she specifically is, like, on the hunt for this married guy.
Yeah.
She knows that she like, is not interested in a single guy.
Nope.
She's like, I want a fucking married guy.
Yep.
Gotta do it. Fuck this old married guy. And let's not beat around the goddamn bush. We all like Alan Rickman, but I don't know that we all want to fuck him.
No.
And I don't know why Mia does.
I don't know why either. I mean, it really does seem like she's in for the necklace.
I mean,
right? That shitty heart necklace.
Yeah, right.
Is it a heart?
It's
a big heart, and there's like a red dot in it.
Every time I was looking at it, I couldn't make out what the shape was.
It's
it was
a heart.
Like,
it's a blobby heart.
Right. It almost looked like it was like a navy bean or something.
It's a blobby fucking heart.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You know, the purchase of said necklace, caught by Emma Thompson, who spies it hidden in his coat pocket, betrays the fact that he
thinks it's for her.
Yeah.
He thinks it's for her, but when it's not given to her on Christmas, the jig is up.
Right.
It's revealed that it was for Mia.
Yeah.
And then, you know, their marriage is destroyed forever, but they have to keep it together for the kids.
I guess. I really don't know.
Question mark.
Yeah, it's a question mark / brutalistic scene of futility.
Merry Christmas.
We've got Sarah, Carl, and Michael. We're going down the... This is the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, scraping the bottom
now.
Here.
Sarah, played by Laura Linney. Yeah.
Right.
Works
right.
Also for the same weird company that Alan Rickman works for. It's her boss. In love with the designer, mysterious hot Brazilian designer named Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Played by Rodrigo Santoro.
Santoro.
Mm-hmm. I almost got that.
Most recently of Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. she's never made a move on him in the 7 years or whatever the fuck.
But everyone
time.
Knows.
Everyone.
Emma Thompson like seems to know, despite
yes.
the fact that Emma Thompson probably doesn't really know who she is.
She touches up her makeup every time he leaves because he passes yep. her desk.
But she's constantly on the phone with this guy, and she calls him Babe, and we're all meant to wonder who Babe is, but
yeah.
no one really cares.
Is it the talking pig from the Universal Picture?
It is. That's the big reveal. Same universe.
And it's revealed at certain point in the movie when she's just about to bed Carl, and she keeps getting these calls and refuses to ignore the calls, that the phone is actually her brother, Michael, who is an unknown type of mentally ill, but probably paranoid schizophrenic,
yeah.
I think is what they're going for, and
yeah.
she is unable to sort of, like, ignore it, which scares Carl away.
And he's in a group...
good,
and he's in, an asylum slash
like a
group home.
Yeah, he's in a group home, and she goes to visit him, and he, you know, he thinks the doctors are trying to kill him.
Yeah.
And then he tries to smack her, and she has to hold his arm back.
Yeah.
Sort of a very emotionally tense scene.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think that it's not a bad scene, it's just a really
no,
weird thing to have in your happy
scene. Yeah.
And then at the bottom, at the very bottom of the barrel,
subterranean levels,
we've got Colin, Sex God, Chris Marshall.
Yeah.
Really, it is just like, you all are waiting for the other shoe to drop in his plotline, and it never fucking does.
Yeah.
Turns out all us American girls just wanted some fucking ugly British dude with a gross Cockney
yeah.
accent.
Who always says gross things like, try my lovely nuts, and
yeah.
shit like that.
So charmed by him just saying words like bottle.
Yeah.
yeah. So Colin is a disgusting human being in the UK, and he thinks that because he's disgusting, or...
Well, he thinks that his
he
only
thinks
problem...
That, yeah, the woman don't want him, not because he's a disgusting, gross individual, but
yeah.
because he's British and everyone else is British, but American girls think he's very cute and hot.
Yeah.
And much to our collective shame, he's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he meets four American girls
yeah.
who are very taken in by him, and you think, they're gonna steal from him?
Yeah.
Is this a fantasy sequence?
Yep.
It's not. They are four dumb American girls who think that Colin / Chris Marshall is somehow attractive or sexy in any way.
So yeah. you know it's fiction. And then just real quick, there's also the Martin Freeman and...
That's right, John and Judy.
What's her face? Gavin and Stacey.
They're stand-ins
yeah.
for a real sexy
yeah,
movie.
So like
they're
always
basically
like,
used as transition scenes.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the sorbet to cleanse your palate in between all the other bullshit, where like you
yeah.
just cut back to them naked in awkward poses, being like, so, do you want to go for a drink?
Yeah, they're having...
How about that traffic?
Yeah.
They're having sort of like jittery first date antics while
yeah.
also naked and pretending to fuck.
Yeah.
It's
just, you know,
it's fine.
I get what you're
yeah.
trying to do here.
Yeah, it's a nothing scene. It adds nothing to the movie except to like
break
know,
it out
of attention.
Yeah.
yeah, and also Rowan Atkinson pops up in two scenes for no real reason.
Yeah, and as is well documented, he was originally intended to be an angel.
An angel, yes.
Which is a theory I would like to explore a little bit.
Which
later.
Led us to the extension theory that Mia was originally intended to be the
a
devil.
Demon.
Right.
But she wears devil horns at
yeah.
the Christmas party.
And why is she so set on this strange
she
mission
is,
that
yeah.
no
she
one
she
can...
is, she's Lilith.
Yeah,
she was God's
or something.
Mistake.
Yeah.
Right, she's the first wife of Adam.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. You really want to see like the scene at the end of Rowan Atkinson flying to heaven away from the airport and like Mia in her apartment just like screams and bursts into flames and pulls back down the thing. I'll get you next year, Alan Rickman.
In her like purple sex closet.
So let's work bottom up. Because
yeah.
I feel like the bottom one's gonna be the worst one.
Yep.
And we'll talk about what is bad.
Yeah.
Or / maybe good about any of these.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're really starting bottom.
Starting with Colin.
We're starting with Colin.
What about John and Judy? Because who gives
Yeah, there's
shit?
Nothing to
well,
say there.
Well, the only note on John and Judy I'll throw out there is I actively cringed when Judy says, all I want for Christmas is you. And you're like, ugh, all right.
Weird.
This is your first date, guys.
Yeah.
Let's reel it in, Judy.
Yeah. Let's chill.
I know he's already seen you naked, but come on.
Yeah. Yeah, Colin.
Colin sex god.
I feel like Colin's friend, when he's pitching this plan of going to America and just on this weird fuck quest he has, his friend tells him, you're a lonely, ugly asshole, and you've got to accept that.
Yeah.
And she's right. He does need to accept that. He's horrible.
Yeah, Colin is maybe the worst character in this movie. And that's
no, he's... Yeah, it's awful. There. I mean, we'll talk about it in the fixes. There are ways you can do this kind of story with this kind of character, but...
They don't do it.
No,
yeah.
It's like I guess the most charitable thing you could say about this is that they were trying to make it like a joke. That like that's all it is.
Yeah.
That maybe it's ironic that he does not meet.
Maybe it's like an inversion of what you expect. Like, you expect him to go to America and like
and get
not meet
shot
anyone.
Down
yeah, by everyone. Right. But like, he meets, and I guess that's it. But like, it's an inversion for such a horrible person. Like, Colin is like a disgusting
yeah.
homunculus.
And
like,
also,
he goes in, like, he's saying like sexy come ons to women. And he's like, I don't understand why none of the women in Britain like me. Like,
why?
What are you missing here?
He is a cater waiter. He goes up to a guest that he is supposed to be serving and goes, taste explosion in your mouth while offering up a hors d'oeuvre. That's disgusting.
Yeah.
Of course you're not getting anything in England.
Yeah, he has no redeeming value.
I mean,
whatsoever.
That's
so much...
your primary example of not try my nuts.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Try my lovely nuts.
Try my lovely
that's
nuts.
That's terrible,
yeah.
too.
But no.
Upon seeing him, like, her legs, like, shuts.
Well, because he goes, like, hello, my future wife, and her whole body, like, caves in.
Yeah.
Like, no. I also just...
She's got too many bosses to fuck.
They show you... They give you multiple reasons to want to see him smack down, but it doesn't happen.
No, and what it does by doing this sort of weird, I guess, like, if it's doing this intentionally or not, if it's doing this inversion, what it ends up doing is then taking down the entirety of American females.
Yep.
By saying that, like, we are all just taken in
yeah.
by this fucking asshole.
They are idiots.
Mm-hmm.
They are... strangely pitching this sexy situation as if it's completely innocent and innocuous.
Yeah.
Like, we have a tiny bed, there's about to be five of us, we're all gonna have to sleep
yeah,
together.
We're
naked.
So
sad.
Yeah, we
but
have no pajamas.
It's never... I feel like there is a way that could have been played where it's like, they know what they're doing, but the way that it comes across is as if, like...
No,
well,
they have no idea.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
Like, and they're good Christian girls.
Yeah, that's
well, oh,
right.
Because one of them, like, he's a Christian,
yeah.
too, because he exclaims, oh God.
But these are not... These women are not human.
Yeah.
Well,
they are not real people.
They're fembots that the writer trotted out of his
yeah, they
own
are like
fantasies.
Some sort of weird Stepford Wyvian people.
Oh my God. That would be an interesting same universe. Like, they were somehow the prototypes that escaped Claire's Stepford.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, he should have been punished in some way?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
I mean, or...
Or should have been denied
something.
What he wanted.
Yeah.
He has no character
growth. Yeah, he doesn't learn anything. He doesn't come back a better person.
No.
He comes back being, like, with reinforcements to continue doing the things that he does.
He comes back with everything that he thought and said validated.
Yeah.
At the risk of sounding like, not, nah, this is bad, this is really bad, but at the risk of something like an MRA, there's an argument to be said that he doesn't need to be punished, but only just, like, taught.
Yeah.
That he's, like, you know, he was raised in a culture that was probably, like, encouraging him to act like this douchebag.
Yeah.
So maybe it is, because he does have moments where you could see that this actor could portray vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if he was taught, like, to get ahead or to get laid, you have to act like this douchebag. He just didn't have the looks or the charisma to carry it off.
Right, he picked up the pickup artist, and
yeah.
that's where this all
yeah.
began for him.
There's an argument to be said that he just needs to be taught that that's not the right way to go about things. But so maybe not punishment, but he needed to have a growth. But he had neither of those things.
The only caveat I'll put on that is that the one person that knows about his plan and knows him as a person tells him consistently that you are disgusting and your plan is disgusting. So I actually would say, is it the culture that brought him up? Because his friend is, like,
well, no,
presumably
I don't think
of the
that
same.
His friend seems to just think that, like, he could do that in that all women are fine. I don't think his friend is, like, a nice man either, really.
No, I
much.
Guess not, yeah.
His friend just seems to think that, like, his main problem is, like, why are you going to America?
Yeah.
There aren't any
yeah.
hot girls in America. They're all dating rich people.
Yeah, they're not going to find you appealing anyway.
That's a good point. I forgot about that line where he's like, yeah, there's a few babes, but they're all with rich, handsome guys.
He said a few. Statistically speaking, we're a much larger country than they are.
Yeah,
there's more
yeah,
than a few.
Yeah,
babes.
You know what, Tony?
Yeah.
We got some babes.
Yeah, okay.
But also, his counterpoint is, like, his argument to Colin is not that, like, they're not gonna want to date you. It's that, well, they're already dating other
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Like, no, they're not.
Every single attractive woman.
That's not the point to make,
right.
Anyway.
It really is, like, the scene, it does. You had said it plays out like a fantasy sequence when
yeah.
he gets off the plane. He wanders into a bar, and there are immediately, like, attractive women sitting there super interested in
him,
and more keep coming in.
Who zero in on him.
Yeah, and so it really does seem like you expect to, like, cut to him waking up on the plane with, like, a dog looking his face or
right.
something. Or, like, I kept expecting him to wake up in the bathtub full of ice with his liver missing or something like that. But, like, it's just
a dark twist.
It never happens.
Yeah.
I also kind of dug your explanation, Brendan, where it was like, if this is real, are they, like,
they're gonna
drain
him
into, like,
yeah.
rob
That's
him?
That's what I'm saying. They're gonna rob him. They're gonna steal some of his organs.
Right.
They're gonna do something. But, like, it just, no, they're bringing him in because they really think he's attractive and want to have sex with him.
It's also just depressing that he then brings back one of those girls who then, like, here's my
sister.
Equally dumb hot sister who immediately starts kissing
Joey.
Well,
and he's also like, I brought, like, he basically says, like, I brought one back for you, friend.
It's
like,
so gross.
Like, I crammed her in the overhead storage.
And by the way, here's your point about the culture. Tony's into it.
Yes.
He's like,
that is true, too. Tony
is
like,
at no point is
right.
he like, what the fuck is going on here?
No,
he's
just like,
pleasantly Denise Richards?
Surprised.
Okay.
Anyway, listen, it's so easy to trash this.
There's nothing more
people.
To say about it, except it's terrible.
It's disgusting.
Next on my list is Sarah, Carl, and Michael, which I put here because it has such a non-ending.
It really does.
What a bummer of a storyline.
Yes.
And that's, I mean, we're going to talk about a bigger one in a second, but, like, she is very hung up on him. She has the world's most inappropriate conversation about it with Alan Rickman. Where he's like, hey, as your boss, I'm asking you how long you've been in love with a coworker.
I mean, as you said, their entire office is an HR disaster.
It is.
Happen.
In fact, if anyone's wondering, Rickman's HR office, by my tally during this movie, has 15 separate HR disasters going on.
Maybe they just fired the HR people.
Too much money.
So,
but it's sad because she clearly wants Carl. Carl seems to know it. He asks her to dance at their Christmas party at the weird naked Christmas gallery.
Mm-hmm.
She takes him home. He's willing to stay. And, you know, that's when brother
calls.
Yeah. And it falls apart for pretty, I think, organic reasons.
Yes.
Calls once and she...
plays it off.
She does it. She deals with it. It takes a minute. And then she's like, sorry, I got this brother. He's got problems. He's got no one else. I have to deal with it. And he's like, we all have something. He's in his stupid ethnic accent. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's the first time he's spoken in the whole goddamn movie.
Well, more than a few words. Because it's,
yeah,
it's sort of
like, bye, Karen.
Or want to dance?
Yeah. And so they resume making out. And then he calls again. And he's like pushing her to, like, maybe, you know, ignore it.
Yeah.
She doesn't. And then at that point, it's like a weird... He's just put in this really awkward position because she moves away from him.
Like, right. She, like, sits on the floor. He's sitting on the bed in his underwear. Just
And he's like, you know, what am I going to do?
She also says, like, no, no, I'm not busy.
Yeah.
Or something like that, which that's pretty hard to hear in him.
No, it's, I think him leaving is a very reasonable thing to do.
It's not, he really, like, he tries to make a go of it, but, like, I think she makes it pretty clear that, like, where her priorities lie.
Yeah.
And I think it's awkward for him because he just starts to feel like an intruder.
Exactly.
And he just sort of makes his natural way out. And then that's it, guys.
Yeah. Well, you see them one more time where, like, they have an awkward, like, Merry Christmas scene.
Well,
and, like, that's it. And then she cries and then she calls her brother.
Because he almost starts a sentence where he's like, you know... And he's like, no. And then leaves.
Yeah, the problem is there's just no time. We gotta get to the nativity scene and all that nonsense. And, like, they never wrote a final scene to this movie.
Story. I think there's something interesting to be said in this movie about portraying love as the relationship between a brother and a sister, as, like, you know, the love they have for each other.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie handles it in the most depressing fashion, where, like, this woman feels obligated to her brother.
Yeah.
And, like, if she isn't there answering the phone, like, what will happen to my brother? Like, this is the rest of her life as she chooses to live it.
Yeah.
And so it's not like, oh, this brother and sister love each other. It's like this woman is in a codependent relationship with her brother and can never leave him be.
She also has essentially sacrificed her life for her brother, and that's what we see in that moment is if she
her romantic life
because she did bring him to England.
Yeah, we assume she's from America, I guess.
Yeah.
She brought her brother.
She says, like, she has no one else over here.
Yeah,
but see,
that's true.
That's what led me to believe that. I feel like what we were seeing there is that he is so much of her life that she hasn't branched out. Not to more friends, not to boyfriends, none of that.
Well, she doesn't really seem to have a whole... Well, she
so
has,
that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, that was her moment to, like, reach out and do something for herself, but she couldn't. And that, oh, that's sad. And that kind of sadness is weirdly balanced with the rest of this movie.
How does she know Peter or Juliet?
Oh, good question.
That's why I thought...
I mean, because... Right, because she's at the wedding.
It couldn't have been
Mia
was new at the company.
She's the same table with Mark. To give some context, in the wedding scene, Mark is sitting and watching the two married... You know, the new married couple, his best friend
Peter
and he's in love with.
Yeah.
And then Sarah is sitting a chair apart, and she sort of moves up to the chair next to him and asks bluntly, like, are you in love with the groom?
Yeah.
But she's in love with him. And the two of you always thought she was a stranger.
Yes.
Asking a really weird question.
Yes.
they had some natural chemistry, and they just launch into what was a very personal topic that to me, I just thought they were friends.
I kind of wanted them to end up together a little bit.
Yeah, my understanding of it was just that she is the sort of person who might ask something blunt and
but
awkward.
She doesn't do anything else straightforward.
It's just what all we ever see is her with Carl, though. We know that she's afraid to approach Carl, but that's just because she's in love.
We see her in one scene with Rickman, and we see her in one scene with
Yeah, the problem is we don't see her really interact with many
if
other
you
people.
Fucking ask me, if you cannot come up to a complete stranger and be like, are you in love with this guy? And you can't ask someone on a date? That's like,
here's,
I don't know.
Here's my read on that.
Because she's so obvious. It's not like she's slightly nervous. It's like she's fucking paralyzed by
fear. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
she is, but I feel like in her head, this is how it played to me. In her head, she's like, I'm really going through this thing with, I want to reach out to Carl, but I can't seem to do it. I'm seeing a guy who appears to be feeling the same thing. I'm reaching out in this moment to someone who's feeling the same problem.
I would also say that maybe she's reluctant to get with Carl because of her relationship with her brother, and she knows
that. Yeah.
Listen, it's not explained, and I think both of her ratings are valid, and I don't want to spend more than 2 minutes arguing about it.
I will say, I think she exhibits so much more confidence in that scene, just in talking with Mark than she does in literally any other scene.
Yeah.
In every other scene, she's like, but I'm not... Shit. A lot of, like, stammering and stuttering, but in this, she's just sort of like,
are you in love?
So many.
With Alan Rickman, even.
But
like that.
Are you in love with the groom? I don't know. I just thought I would ask the question in case it was the right one. And she just has this very, like, self-assured air that evaporates.
And she's so wrong as well, on top of it all.
Well, I can understand. Honestly, the first time I saw this movie, I thought it was going to go that way.
Well, that's because they're doing the montage trick where they show him, they show a shot of him.
Right.
Then you see
Juliet.
Mark's face.
Yeah.
No, you don't see Juliet. No. You see Mark. You see, because Juliet's got her back.
Right.
So you see Mark's face, then you see Peter's face, then Mark's face, and then you see Sarah being like, And so it's meant to instantly look like he's gay, but that's a
interesting
red herring.
Rest assured, there are no gay people in this movie, viewers.
There was, and then they cut it out.
Yes, the deleted scenes are on the DVD and Blu-ray. If you want to see, who was it? What's her name?
Anne Reed?
Yeah.
And
Frances de la Tour as a lesbian couple, one of whom is the headmaster of the school. And then Frances de la Tour dies without comment and without actually seeing her die.
Off screen.
Yeah, through the movie. And then, like, there's a deleted scene where Amitas is like, we're so sorry about your wife dying. She was a great lady.
It's a bummer just because, well, I mean, you know, add it to the list.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a sidebar thing real quick. But, like, the only two people who were gay who were going to be in this movie are these two women, one of whom was going to die. And, like, they're both marginalized in terms of the plot. They have almost nothing to do even in that version. So, like, again, there's a lot of straight people and a lot of white people.
Well, the only people that win are men.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, and if we can also say, like, is that not reflective of a lot of how much queer fiction is told almost always as a weepy, almost always someone's gonna die, like, and especially what, this was 2007?
Three, sorry, even worse.
It speaks to a bigger issue, this movie in general, of, like, the tonal whiplash you have from going between, like, frothy, like, rom-com moments to, like, hard emotional moments between, like, Laura Linney and her brother, or, like, Alan Rickman cheating on his wife, and, like, all this shit that, like, it's so diametrically opposed to the rest
of the movie. Listen, we got a lot of movie to get through. Let's move on to Karen, Mia, and Harry.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Who is Mia? Who is she? Who is this woman?
Again, not a real person. She's about as real as the four American girls from Colin's Powerline, because there's no fucking way that a woman on this, on God's earth, is like, I want to fuck Alan Rickman.
And nothing else.
As a 56-year-old man.
So it was
for no other reason than he's married and because it's Alan Rickman.
It really, and again, it makes no sense. She never has a reason. Like, I'm not saying, like, we need to hear why, but, like, what's her purpose here?
It's pure sex slash there's absolutely no love, nor does she make any affectation that it's
about.
They also put nothing into telling you why this is happening. It just sort of is. And that's almost reflected in Rickman's performance, where, like, he goes off and he tells her when he's leaving the office, I'm going to the mall to meet my wife, and we're buying gifts for the family, and I'll probably get something for her. And then she calls him and is like, are you going to get something for me? And his reaction is like, oh, I guess. Is that what we're doing now?
Like, I guess I'm doing this affair now.
But that part is insane. I feel like viewing Mia through the lens that she is a literal demon from hell actually makes a lot of sense.
It's the only possible explanation.
Because then it's funny then to think, you know, because she pops up towards the end of the movie as What's-Her-Nuts' neighbor.
Yeah,
Natalie's
neighbor. But she's like, oh, Natalie lives next door. And you guys were like, well, if she's a demon, why is she putting this love match together? I'm like, she wants to destroy the Empire.
Yeah, she's getting ready for Brexit. She's setting the stones.
Yep. In a few years, she'll be running for PM.
Yeah, exactly.
She kind of looks like Theresa May.
I was going to say, right?
I never.
She's like, wow. Theresa May.
It's the eyes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the crazy doll eyes.
Yeah.
She looks like a Bratz doll. It's insane. She spreads her legs so wide.
I forget what the fuck I was going to say about this plotline, but
well,
it's real bad.
It is, because it's just, for all the world, it really looks like she wants to fuck him and she wants a necklace. Like, the necklace
yeah.
is her end
well,
goal here.
Here's what I was going to say. Rather than being, like, rather than being, like, tempted by this demon, Alan Rickman seems like he's just put down by a
yeah,
demon.
He's, like, reluctantly going in with
yeah,
the
he's
like, what else
yeah.
can you do?
And, by the way, Alan Rickman as an actor puts in...
No
effort. Tenths
yeah.
of an effort.
Yeah.
It's, okay, and...
Which I get, because that actor...
No, I get. There's
right,
nothing
like,
there.
No interest or willpower whatsoever.
So there's,
yeah.
there's 2 points I want to cover with one shot. And it's the shot, and they do it twice, over his shoulder, of her spreading her legs so wide in what Lee described, what did you say? It was like a junior's pencil skirt with ruffles
well,
or whatever
like,
it was.
Yeah, like JCPenney.
But
it's like for children.
He looks at that with no emotion on his face.
It's almost like disdain. He's almost
yeah.
like,
well, but then he sort of just shrugs and it's like, I have to go to my office. And
yeah.
you never get heat or interest or anything. He's
no.
just sort of like, okay.
The two have no chemistry, and it's like she just keeps throwing herself at him until he's finally just like, well, all right, I guess we're
And they don't even do anything.
Well, see,
not
that's
on screen.
The thing.
Not on screen.
You don't, but apparently, per the filmmakers, there's a shot of her, like, with the necklace where her sheets are rumpled
yes.
in the background that's supposed to imply that they have
Well,
sex.
And she gets close to camera, and it's as if the camera is her vanity mirror because she's,
yeah.
like, putting
yeah.
the necklace on and admiring
but,
it.
But, again, because we don't actually, no one... confirms that this happens in the movie. So, like,
in
for
fact,
all, it doesn't happen.
The script leaves it very much in question because Emma Thompson is like, I don't know
yeah.
if it's sex and whatever. I don't know if it's sex and love. I don't know, yada, yada, yada.
It sounds like a character written by a man.
Yeah.
Right?
No, it's exactly like,
well,
she's just like a slutty temptress.
Yeah.
But it's also like, this young woman so badly wants to fuck this older man who's in a position of authority over her. Of course, Emma Thompson in this role, though, does good work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Emma Thompson brings it.
I would like to officially add her to next to Stanley Tucci on a list of people who can elevate really terrible material.
Mm-hmm.
And she does.
She does, for sure.
Because it's pretty crappy what she has to do. I mean, also, a lot of her dialogue is like how fat she is and like how like unattractive she
feels. Crazy.
It is. Like, Emma Thompson, one of the most beautiful women ever.
Yeah.
And she's like talking
There's
about
multiple
like,
levels of fat shaming in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll get into
yes.
it later. But Emma Thompson says how like, I can only wear clothes that Pavarotti used to wear or something like that. And she has on like, the frumpiest sweaters and like the largest pants to like make her look dumpy.
The craziest thing about it is if there was going to be a subversion in which most of that was her own self-esteem issues and that, oh, I actually do really have this great body or whatever, that would have been amazing, but it's not. It's a super huge bummer just because Emma Thompson is beautiful and so charming. And even when she's like speaking these nonsensical expositional lines about whatever, this, that, and the other, I was drawn in. I was like, Emma, I'm here with you.
No, she does do. I think she plays the scene very well where she expects to get a necklace and it's a Joni Mitchell CD.
Oh, God.
And she cries.
Crushing.
So brutal.
Yeah, no, it is. And again,
this
from
is
a different
movie.
Yeah.
yeah.
And also the
Crushing.
Scene after the nativity play where she says, like, you've made the life I lead foolish too by
yeah.
having a fair. And
love
again,
that line.
It's very good, but like, why am I watching this in my Christmas rom-com?
Yeah, I mean, also probably better written as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is so weird and small. I'm just going to, this last note.
This is the last note.
I agree.
We got to move on.
But when
Bro, it's so late.
But when she's crying in the bedroom after the whole didn't get the necklace scene,
uh-huh.
I love the bit of physical acting where she just sort of leans over in the bed for a second and just heaves and then gets back up. It was wonderful.
Yeah, and just like wipes her eyes off and goes back to the living room and like nothing happened.
It was
yeah.
it was an acting clinic just in that
it
scene.
It is.
Billy Mack and the manager, I put them pretty low because I don't care that much, but I also don't think that there's really anything wrong with them.
No, it's like it's a
nice story.
It's like a comic little subplot.
Yeah.
You get like Billy Mack, this washed up former drug addict trying to like have
yeah.
one last blaze of glory in his life.
What I will say is you thought it would be cheap. I talked about the notion of what if their love was romantic but not sexual, and you said you thought it would be cheapening what is a nice friendship.
Yeah.
I have a counterpoint to that, which is that I would love to see more stories about romantic love that isn't sexual.
I agree with that completely.
And so I would love for that to have been the case with this plotline. It is left, I guess, like, fairly ambiguous, but, like, heavily implying that it is just a friendship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love for it to be an overtly romantic love that they have for each other.
I would like...
sort of a soulmates thing.
I would be totally into that, but my problem is... I would love it for it to be an acknowledged on-screen, very deep friendship between two men that doesn't have to be sexualized or romanticized.
That's fair, too.
That's also fair.
Because I feel like a lot of times, affection between men, both spoken and physical, is automatically gay, and nothing wrong with that, obviously, but...
Although, also, it does end with him saying, like, let's go in the other room and jerk off to porn.
Ooh, that was a weird...
Which is a weird, like, no, it isn't, because it is almost like, wait, they're not gay, right?
But they sounded, like, really happy about it.
Yeah, they're like,
hey, sure. He's all thrilled.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they call Wednesday
like
night, apparently.
Yeah, like a normal Saturday evening.
Yeah.
The only thing I'll put in is, I think it's in that plot line that we kind of flit in and out of almost as infrequently as we do in the sexy stand-in one.
Yeah.
It's the most pointed criticism, I think, of culture we really get in this movie. With, like, the whole kind of, like, the femme body women in his music video just, like, licking their lips and stuff. Like, I was like, okay, I actually see the joke you're making here, and that's cool.
Yeah. I think it's a funny, like, it's a funny little nothing of a plot, and Bill Nighy is very good in it. In a weird way, his song Christmas is All Around is a metaphor for this movie, because based on a song called Love is All Around that was from, like, the 60s, and what he's doing is he's throwing on, like, some Christmas trappings and trying to make it, like, a Christmas thing that people love, which is a metaphor for this movie. It's,
absolutely,
like, taking these, like, old things, dusting them off, throwing Christmas on it all over, and, like, wanting people to love it. And to be fair, in both the movie and in real life, it seems to have worked.
It's successful.
This movie is a world tour of bad romantic tropes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next on the list is Peter, Mark, and Juliet. Now, I do not want to repeat any of the long-winded debates we had about this off.
I don't either.
We're not going to.
We could do a thing where each one of you states your point, and then there's no further.
What I will say is...
We came to a point of understanding
there
about
was,
it.
What I will say is, what it came down to was a confusion of viewpoints that we sorted out off mic. But I think there are still, to this day, I think, a percentage of people that find Mark to be incredibly creepy, mm-hmm. and a percentage of people that find him to be not creepy, and also a percentage of people that find it to be romantic, like on the other end of the spectrum,
right.
creepy. I am squarely in the middle. Where I don't
so
think
you're in
it's,
the not creepy.
Yeah, I don't think it's romantic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's creepy. Chris and you definitely agree that it is creepy. I can understand
creepy.
Where you're coming from with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, there it's weird for sure, and I can understand. And we talked about this is rooted squarely in 90s rom-com tradition of like grand romantic gestures
mm-hmm.
that if you were to ever do them in real life, you're a fucking stalker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's problematic from my point of view to keep doing these, and I think it's glad... I'm good that we've, for the most part, stopped putting them in movies, because it perpetuates this idea... Like, if men watch this for any reason, not that these movies are marketed towards men, and they think that this is, like, at all okay behavior for them, it's bad.
Yeah, if a girl ignores you, just, like, get a boombox.
Yeah, get a boombox,
get
out of the house until she acknowledges you,
right?
Right,
yeah.
The say anything.
Yeah, eventually she'll come down and kiss you.
Yeah, like, run to the airport after her.
Right, she's trying to, like, leave her life behind. You keep chasing her.
Just grind her down.
Yep.
Yeah.
The one thing I want to throw in real quick.
Mm-hmm.
I get the grand romantic gesture part, and I do see how that's a thing that can play in movies.
Yeah.
The problem I have with it mostly is it's a little bit of that, but the problem that I also have stems from the fact that she is married and he's telling her this now, and it's drawing her husband into like this complication effectively.
Because
he shows up and says, like, I think I will always think you're perfect. I love you. I will love you even when you're a mummy. And then she like runs after him, kisses him on the lips, and runs
back
upstairs.
Which is weird as well.
It's super weird. Yeah.
Not the message you want to send.
Kiss on the cheek. Be like, we'll be friends. Like,
right.
I appreciate your honesty in this, but like, this is my husband. This is who I love. This is who my life is with. Like, I hope we can be friends.
I don't think Keira Knightley is a real woman either in this movie.
No.
She's like, again, she's 18 when she filmed this.
And
she is like a fucking child.
And she is an object to be coveted in this movie, which is an issue.
She is another like elfin woman.
Yeah, popping up with her banoffee pie.
And her stupid hat.
Stupid hat, right? The hat! We never talked about it, but we all knew.
Guys, in this movie, there is an epidemic of bad headwear.
Yeah.
Which, just take that. But, okay. That's a problem, but the other thing about it is, I am very sympathetic to someone who's in the situation of unrequited love, and I don't think that there was a non-messy way out of this situation.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think it is irresponsible to burden someone else with the idea of, I love you, but I'm going to sit over here on the sidelines, and also your husband's my best friend. The other thing I think that is fucked up about this is because you put this plot line in the middle of all of this fluff, that in my head contextualizes it as the intention to be equally fluffy and romantic, and that's an issue because I do not find this to be fluffy or romantic at all.
See, I think the biggest issue with this in general is that as you said, yes, this is a very complicated territory to be in. And yeah. I get that. I understand that. The problem is that this is one of, like, what, 9 plots in this movie? And therefore, you can't begin to do it justice by just, like, skimming to, like, the bare bones. And I think because this story, because there is just, like, the barest beats of a romantic plot for this plotline, it's easy to see why someone could look at this and be like, oh, this is appealing to me. Like, because the characters are so vague and the actions are so simple that I could see why someone would watch this and be like, I hope a man will do this to me someday. And I could see why someone would watch it and be like, what a fucking creep.
Because it sort of is almost like, from a marketing standpoint, almost like the perfect movie in that way, because it's all, almost all of it is, I can project myself onto this total blank canvas of a character. But I think generally the problem with this plot, and then in a weird, slightly different way, the Colin Firth plot, is they both suffocate for lack of room to spread out and develop. So the barest beats you get don't give you enough of a story to contextualize it enough to really feel okay with what's going on. And at least for my part, I felt like the movie really wanted me to be okay with this situation, and I wasn't.
My thoughts on this plotline are that I really am fascinated by it, and I would love to see it done. I really like the character of Mark as a whole. I like his response to the situation, which is a really awful, excruciating situation to be in, and one that I am sort of into. I think we talked about it in a different episode about how, like, I'm really into impossible / unrequited love stories sometimes. I would be totally down for this as a whole movie. I do think it is really weird to handle it. I crossed off Peter's, Mark's, Juliet's, Karen, Mia, Harry, and Sarah, Carl, Michael as three stories that, like, I don't know how you totally mix them in with everything else.
Yeah. No,
the rest
you can't.
Of them are so fluffy. In general, I think it's a fasting sort of conquer. I don't think this movie does it very well for reasons aforementioned.
One last problem with this scene, when he shows up with the boombox and it's carolers, it's like a woman group singing carols in 4-part harmony with musical accompaniments, and he tells Keira Knightley to tell her husband, tell him it's carolers, and he plays like a professional CD that you expect him to, like, her husband to run down the stairs and be like, holy shit, who are these great carolers
I'm gonna make that video someday where we watched it the first time and I said, imagine if you were seeing this scene with like actual shitty carolers.
Yeah, like, I would hear like a bunch of 10-year-olds singing Jingle Bells or something.
The other just small issue with this whole plan is, what if Peter had answered the door?
Yeah, exactly.
Then you're standing
in a boombox. You're like, hey, buddy.
Hey, can you go back upstairs and send Juliet down? No, babe, don't question it.
All right, done.
Yep.
Daniel, Sam, Joanna. Another bummer. I'm going to mark an X. It should be a bummer. It's actually less of a bummer than it should be.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Daniel's wife has just fucking died.
Yeah, we see the funeral.
She is fresh in the grave.
Yeah. Sam's mother is
dead.
Yeah.
And he's inconsolable. And then you find out that, no, actually, he doesn't give a shit that his mom's dead.
Yeah.
Well, he does. I think he
pays lip service to
exactly.
He says something like, I know I should be sad about mom, and I am, but I've been in love with her for, like, a long time.
But no, this kid is actually, it's truly not Joanna's child. He is an elfin chain.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. Right. When you know that King Oberon has placed him in exchange, like, a baby of ice or something.
Right, exactly. And on the full moon, he hears the song of Sweet Titania. But the crazy thing about it is, if you're going to invoke very recently dead mom, then you just breeze right past the emotional burden of that. That's insane.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no way that Daniel as Liam Neeson doesn't have to pick up the pieces as a new father. Like,
yeah. And again, and like, also, this is not his kid, which is the biggest part of this. Like, this is a family he married into.
Right.
And now he's in the awkward position of having to be the only parent to this child who is not his child in the first place. So, like, it's awkward for both of them. And it wants to portray that, and it does a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it wants this idea to be that, well, they're bonding together because of, you know, Liam Neeson trying to help his stepson figure out his love and how to win this girl's hand. But again, it's done so quickly that you don't get any of the emotional beats of him trying to get past his wife's death.
It's another plotline that could have done with some more space that just was not a possibility
more
in this
space
movie.
And also just, like, I don't know, the kid being sad about his mom being dead?
Yeah.
Like, it's just weird.
It's so much to cover.
Daniel should be more emotionally in control than Sam.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's not. He's, like, ready to break down any moment.
in the beginning, but that changes pretty quickly. Yeah. And by the end of the movie, he's well ready to move on with Carol.
Yeah, with Claudia Schiffer. In the space of a fucking week.
It's a week. I think it's a month, but that's still too fast.
Yeah, let's assume max, it's max 5 weeks. Yeah. Probably less than that. Which is, again, yeah.
Crazy.
So fucking fast. That and is... I know, again, she was sick for a while. He was probably in a place where he was, like, mentally preparing himself for this for a long time.
Yeah.
But my God.
I know. Well, and just when you're putting that in a movie, I feel like you're saying something that you don't want to say. You know what I mean? Where it's like, yeah, your spouse is dead, but rom-com!
Yeah.
The bummer about that to me is I actually, it felt like they thought it was necessary for the kid to have a crush in school, and I thought it would have been more interesting that if we're going to explore these different forms of love, then perhaps we could talk about the love for someone who is dead, particularly, in this case, a child for his dead mother.
I mean, I think my biggest takeaway is the love between, you know, this the stepfather and his stepson at the end of the day. Like, that's the relationship that I'm here for. I get what you're saying. That is a very interesting point of view that you could bring up, but it's not something I want in my Christmas rom-com movie.
I mean, I don't want this plotline in my Christmas rom-com at all. You know what I mean? Like, but if it has to be here, we need a little more emotional honesty.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting to have a new father bond, a father bonding with a kid. But I don't know how to do that without being depressed about someone who's just died.
No, it's true. Again, you lose nothing by bumping back this funeral like 6 months.
I see your point, though. It would have been really good plotline to see, like, hey, we kind of maybe had this one bond before, but now in this new situation, we're forging this new one. That would have been really beautiful.
Yeah, if it was just more like a business-like father and son thing, where it was like, I feed you and make sure you go to school on time.
Yeah, and now it's them learning how to, like, be a family.
Yeah.
A new family unit in this new reality. I think that would have been beautiful. Yeah.
Well, we fixed it. Good job.
Ta-da, we're done. Go home.
Jamie and Aurelia, I think I'm fine. I think I'm better off fine with this plotline than you guys might be.
I have like one issue with, and that is the language barrier.
Yes. So there's a bit of what you would call magical realism in this plotline because for some reason Aurelia knows no fucking English whatsoever, which is inconceivable to me.
In 2003.
Yeah.
And it's inconceivable that I mean, I guess like. We're pretty dumb with languages in America, and so I guess people in the UK could be equally pretty dumb. But I just can't imagine that France, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, all being romance languages that you can't get some cognates straight.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she doesn't speak French.
That's true. They also, like...
How?
Yeah, they...
How are you not... How are you not able to pigeon communicate what is the same root language?
Yeah.
Well, they also... The magical realism portion is also... They're both saying more or less the same thing, just in separate languages, but at the same time.
Yeah.
Always. And that was my thing. I actually liked the moment where that first happens with his pages of his manuscript go flying off of that writing gazebo.
Yeah, yeah. That's the magical realism bit.
That's nice in that moment, but then it's stretched over the whole
Well, it's pretty much every one of their scenes. It really is every one.
From that point on, there's a whole lot of where he'll say something and she'll say something that's in response to it or complimenting it or like making fun of it that like he doesn't understand.
They're coincidentally talking about the same thing.
Where he says the happiest part of my day is picking
driving
you up
you. Driving you
or driving you and she says it's the saddest part
of my day is leaving you. Not getting out of the car as you
saddest part of my day is getting out of the car.
You have one of those really great bead backrests there.
Yeah. Well, I love the heated seats.
I love how when it gets cold I can stay warm.
Yeah. I think I don't want to draw a direct comparison to that, but I might as well call out now that this watching Love Actually again reminded me of a Bollywood movie called Salaam Ishq from 2007, which for sure borrows at least a couple plot lines from Love Actually.
But does them better.
Does them better. It's similarly structured as an anthology love story, but it's also 2 hours longer than Love Actually.
Well, Lee, you showed me this movie, and it was interesting because when you told me the length, I mentally balked a little. I was like, that's a long
one. We watched it over two nights. It's very long.
But
it's 3 hours and 30 minutes.
I found that I appreciated how long it was because it was another movie that was juggling a lot of plot lines, and they're all kind of more or less around the idea of love and the
No, it solves a lot of the problems it actually has simply by being 2 hours longer.
Yes. Well, because there's just more time dig in.
The first, we watched this a few nights ago, and at one point you said something like, well, we're nearing the end of the movie, right? And we were like 45 minutes.
That's so bad.
An hour and 15 minutes left of the movie, and you were convinced that, like, well, it's gotta be over soon.
Right? Like, we were in the middle of the Jamie and Aurelia plotline, and I was like, kind of close to the end. Like,
oh, no, no way.
Nope.
My point that I was trying to make is that there is a. This is one of the plotlines that sort of exists in Salama-ish, which is that there's a language barrier romance with a white woman from America and an Indian guy mm-hmm. who's like a taxi driver, so he's working class. He doesn't really speak English that well. However, English is still an official language in India, and she specifically come to India because she had an Indian boyfriend that she wants to get back together with. And so they each know, like, a few words.
Right.
And she's actively trying to learn Hindi. And so instead of it being, like, they magically understand each other, they're both sort of speaking, you know, 90% their language and 10% the other language. Yeah. And, like, meanings come across using a lot of physical communication. And you get, the way they talk even, where he says, like, why didn't you, like, tell her? Like, they're, like, putting, like, their hands from their mouth as if they're, like, speaking
right.
words.
Yeah. Well, I would say Salama-ish puts the work in.
Yeah.
I saw that.
And this movie has, like, a cram session. As soon as, as soon as they split up, the two of them, they go back to their separate countries. Like, you see Colin Firth, like, sitting in a school, like, with headphones on, like, learning phrases in Portuguese. And so, like, he somehow managed to learn, like, enough to both have a conversation with her father, understand what her father was saying.
Yeah, her
and
father
then,
did not slow it down.
Yeah, no. He got me pretty fucking impressed that Colin Firth knew what her father was saying, because that is some tricky shit.
Yeah.
And then he could still go to the restaurant, propose to her, and, like, it's jokey. So, like, he's getting some things wrong and, like, fucking some tenses. But, like, the message is getting across.
Right.
Do you want to talk real quick about the fat shaming, since it pops up in here?
Yeah.
It does pop up a little bit in here, because Aurelia's sister's, you know, a larger woman.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you mean Miss Dunkin' Donuts 2003.
Donut singular, the one donut.
Which is definitely not what he said, because the Dunkin' Donuts is not a franchise that big over there.
Yeah.
It's an airport, and, like, maybe there's one per city.
It's not Little Lisbon.
For sure.
Yeah.
Where they speak neither French nor English.
I mean, did he go to France, or did he go to Portugal?
He went to France. Because they show him that, I forget what airport it is, but it's definitely written in French.
Okay.
So, like,
I thought maybe she went back home.
Yeah, maybe he went to Portugal.
Yeah.
Also, bonkers to me that he flew there on Christmas Eve. Like,
no way.
If we're being charitable, he popped into his relative's house at 5 p.m. and was like, nope, gotta get out of here. Somehow managed to get on a plane, get to France, find her, and, like, before Christmas Eve.
Restaurant.
Yeah. This is bullshit.
And on the way to that restaurant, they gathered the entire neighborhood.
Can I say something? I kind of love the scene of, like, the entire neighborhood. Like, it's weird to me because it's just, like, it becomes creepy that he, like, drags an entire crowd to, like, watch him propose to this woman he barely knows.
But it's,
again, other problem.
Yeah.
They get engaged in the end. Bullshit.
But the thing is, like, at least that's not really him. That's just, like, everyone else. But
right.
It's like a telephone game of, like, they're selling her to slavery or something. Like,
though, if that plot line were to have been at home in its own magical realism film, that would have fit a lot better. Like, if this was an Amelie kind of setup, I'm there.
Yeah.
I remember what I was going to say, by the way. I love a lot of the plot beats in this, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea of figuring out your love across a language barrier is a very beautiful thing. I'm really interested in that. That's super cool. However, I think a lot of the problems we have with it in terms of this cram session is just because they have to compress the timeline so severely.
Right.
And so I think really my only problem with this plotline is it needs more space and time. I know I've said that like three times now, but that's the repeat. That's the recurring problem in Love Actually.
Yeah. More time. Also, maybe go on a date first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I'll let you move on real quick with this, but like, it is very difficult to date people from a different culture entirely.
Yes.
And I've tried some of this before with, like, guys from other countries
mm-hmm.
who were here for, like, whatever reason. And, like, it is just very difficult to have, like, similar, you know, backgrounds or references in pop culture. And so, like, when you have two people who don't speak the same language, have grown up very different lives, and now they're already getting married, it's like, this is a recipe for disaster.
Well, if we're going to go off of body shaming, let's springboard
Let's talk about the Prime Minister.
Yep.
Now listen, this is hands down the best thing about this movie.
I agree.
Ran as the Prime Minister.
I prefer what's everyone's favorite storyline?
Prime Minister.
I'd say it's a tie between this one and the Colin Firth one.
Mine is the Liam Neeson one. Okay, continue.
Hmm.
Prime Minister and Natalie. So, you're sorting out your priorities in life.
Absolutely.
For one thing, we've talked about this. Pretty sure Chris is spot on with Natalie is a size 8 at best.
Yeah.
She is smaller than me.
Yeah.
You're damn sure.
Yep.
But it's so insane how many separate characters are like, she's fat, she's chump, plump, or what was it?
Plumpy.
Plumpy.
Her
dad calls her plumpy. Her ex-boyfriend called her fat. The chief of staff, I guess.
She's a pretty sizable arse.
Yeah.
Pretty sizable arse on that one, sir.
The first time it comes out is that she's talking about her ex-boyfriend. She's like, oh, I broke up with him because he called me fat. And I'm like, oh, you have a douchebag boyfriend.
Yeah.
Need go
no
further.
Yeah.
The world thinks that she is fat.
World is her douchebag boyfriend.
I would even go so far as to say her body looks amazing in whatever she's... I mean, she's wearing pencil skirts. There's a waist. She has... a sizable bosom. I mean, like, her body is pretty ideal, I think, for a lot of men, especially, I guess, the writer and director of this movie.
Yeah.
It's insane to me that she's taking these slings and arrows over her body.
And I think this is probably before, like, sort of Kardashian, like,
ass obsession.
Let's have booties and curvy, but, like, it's nevertheless, you're still not fat. There's
well,
so many degrees you could go.
What I kind of want to know, and I kind of want to get what, like, Richard Curtis is doing here, and I'm curious as to whether or not, like, one, is she supposed to be, like, movie fat? Is that what he's doing?
Probably.
Or is it just that, like, this is some sort of weird British infatuation with stoutness, where it's like cute when they do it, and not supposed to be like a bad thing. Either way, it reads terribly.
It does read terribly, especially because the only break in that chain, if it's supposed to be cute, the chief of staff does not find it cute.
No, the chief of staff, like,
well, then the prime minister balks at the assessment.
Yeah,
because he seems to. So everyone seems to imply that it is bad.
Yeah, except for the chief of staff again, who is like, who becomes like malevolent for that one scene.
Yeah,
she's
so bizarre.
Chubby girl.
She has no reason to dislike her.
Yeah, no, she says it so bitchy too. Like she's just like offhand, like oh the chubby one.
Pretty
like,
sizable arse.
Yeah,
on that
yeah,
one.
Pretty sizable arse. Like if she just had an offhanded oh the chubby one, okay, like I would have, I wouldn't be like okay, but I would kind of get it. But she's just spiteful.
I get the impression. There's an open door policy in this administration where people are just kind of like saying willy-nilly to each other, but I really feel like that was a bridge too far to be like, you're talking about one of your co-workers, your boss, who is also the prime minister.
Well, the British government is very
why
different from ours,
why did the chief of staff, by the way, not know the person that he introduced? She introduced him to her.
Yeah.
Right.
You know her name. You don't have to refer to her as the chubby one.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Whatever.
Why are you
anyway,
such a bitch?
Let's get past the fat shaming and
talk
about the
actual Billy
story.
Bob Thornton, too? Because we didn't really mention him.
Yeah, Billy Bob Thornton is the president of the United States.
A prescient performance.
He's like it's like sort of like if Trump had any level of suavity.
Well, he's like George Bush. He's like George Bush, but
he's like George
Trump's
Bush.
Voracious, like,
it's George Bush. I would say it's Clinton's, like, sexual.
I think it's Clinton's charm.
Stuff.
Like, he's supposed to be,
it's
like,
the charm. But like where the Trump comes in is just like the absolute, like, you just think it's okay to be like, yeah, let's grab that
ass. Just like go to him and like grab her face.
He has thrown decorum and caution to the wind because almost immediately when she passes them on the stairs on the way to, I don't know, some meeting room or office, he so obviously like tracks her going down the stairs.
Yeah.
Then turns to the prime minister and says something
like nice pipes on her.
Right.
Like that.
Which
is
corrupt. Oh, he says something else too, I think. He winds up into the nice
he
pipes.
He says, like, I would tap that in a second or something.
Yeah.
Like, if
he
was
like,
here.
It was something like, oh, if that was in the White House, and you're like, gross.
Yeah.
And
he also, the prime minister leaves that room
for 10 seconds.
Like, to get a pen or something. He goes to the other room, comes back, and the president of the U.S.
has already moved in.
Face in his hand and is like whispering,
sniffing
her
hair.
Yeah, he's sort of like going for a hair sniff. I'm not really sure what's going on.
Or whispering.
There.
Actually, I would accept
but
whispering
you know
in the
what?
Air a little
you
more.
You know, you didn't have time to do anything.
Right?
Like,
you fucking lunatic. That's why, was it supposed to be a power move? Like, because there is.
A lot of it is always a power move, right?
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, more specific to this movie
but
than
not
this.
To the, but not to the prime minister. It was
no.
a power move on her.
Well, maybe
it was the
prime minister.
Was doing a power move.
Yeah.
I also think it's a. Pardon me of the Prime Minister, and I'll make my case on this very briefly.
I'll watch yourself, Counselor.
thank you, Your Honor.
Because did he sense that the Prime Minister was also attracted to this guy?
No. When I thought
was
it
he
was,
trying to cuck the PM?
Probably, but what I think it was this. I would love if they had said cuck, and then clearly it just been...
I mean, if the speech at the end between the two of them, he's like, I'm done being cucked by the President.
And it was like... In the not politics that they talk during these scenes where they're like, we need to make a stand. America's always bullying, pushing us around. I think that was supposed to be an extension of that. He wasn't necessarily picking up on the fact the prime minister was into her, but he was like, you have something I want, so I'm taking it right now. And I'm showing you that I can move in and take it.
I mean,
just like in these,
like,
just like in these vague policies.
If you're telling me that you, I think if you're saying that the president was making any level of power movement against the PM, then you are saying that he somehow knew that Natalie
not necessarily
was his object
the PM,
of affection.
I think he's just showing, I'm going to take what I want.
I get what you're saying, Chris. I think it's reading into it at a
too
level
much.
That they did not intend.
Okay.
Like, it's
far
like,
too much.
That's too smart of an interpretation for this movie.
Okay.
So, like, the idea that like the president just takes whatever he wants.
And it is also still a sexist thing to have in a movie that like
oh completely
they are basically what amounts to them fighting over policies is them fighting over the affection of
yeah women.
And that
yeah.
it's a token to be passed back
yeah.
and forth.
It should also be said that the talk of politics in this movie is hilarious.
Oh, it's so
it is just
so
it's like people sitting in meetings being like, so what about your policies? Well, we're going to keep an eye on the policies, but those are terrible policies.
Should we have strong policies?
Yes.
Well, I do love these like, what are we going to do for the American visit? I think we should be strong. Yes,
yeah.
strong!
But no, but not so strong.
Yeah, yeah, we can't be very strong.
Yes,
yeah,
it's
America.
Not even like...
But we should be clever!
About any topic, this would not be
yeah.
like high-level communication.
Yeah.
It's just like, we should be... X, but not that X.
I mean, you can make this
about
anything. You can make it about trade policies. You
yeah.
can make it about, like, any dumbass
thing. Especially in the UK,
that.
You just make, like, a sort of nationalistic stance about, like, yeah, we're gonna, like, you know, stop being so codependent on the US.
Yeah. I do agree with you, though. For the most part, it's a strong, like, the snag with the American president is what sort of ruins it all for me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
it's very easy to have a very cute, fun relationship between these two,
mm-hmm.
but when you throw in this whole idea of, like, strength and Britain being strong, and then you throw her into the mix, it just becomes
yeah.
such a fucking mess.
I thought of the one thing about how she's used as a weird sort of token, so it's impetus for the prime minister to make a bold stance.
Mm-hmm.
I
on
think
something.
That the prime minister handles the power dynamics very responsibly, in that he is aware of how he feels about this woman who works under him,
mm-hmm.
And doesn't want to like take advantage of it, and so he has her like reassigned. I think he could maybe have done it in a way that doesn't make it her think, as she
right.
probably likely did, that she did something wrong.
Right,
right, because it's not like she's getting reassigned to a better position that we know of. She's getting reassigned to something else.
Something
like,
outside of
because,
his purview.
Because doesn't she, in that letter, she's like, I'm sorry if I made you angry, or
yeah.
whatever it was.
It
like,
feels
yeah.
like, it reads as a punishment, almost.
I mean, it would, if you don't give an explanation. Whereas,
yeah.
like, if I was in that position, if I was in that situation, I would be like, could we do something that makes it look like she's advancing, but
yeah.
like, is not, I don't have to see her anymore
yeah.
because it's weird that I have to see her in a work situation.
I also just want to point out that it's in this storyline that we all agree we see the finest acting that's in this movie, and it's of the little kid in the octopus
yes.
costume. He's seated between Hugh Grant and Natalie, having this kind of like very rapid fire back and forth about how like, I thought you thought this, and I thought you felt this, and I'm sorry, and I
yeah.
meant this, and yada yada yada, and he's just sort of sitting there like looking at one and then the other, and it's telegraphs a lot with very little.
Yeah.
So good on you, child.
That kid did some great acting.
Final yeah. observation, I kept running tallies in this movie, and the one I really just want to headline up there is the number of times Colin is gross came by my count to 20 times he is gross.
I believe it.
I wasn't keeping track.
It's that low, frankly.
I wasn't keeping track of any of this shit, and I'm
he's
not going to contest any of their claims.
For how few of the times he's in this movie, I think that's pretty
There funny. Is like an hour-long stretch where Colin is not in this movie.
And it's refreshing.
It's the most beautiful hour of this movie.
Yeah,
you forget he exists, and then he pops up again outside his best friend's flat. And it's like, oh, fuck, I have to deal with this bullshit again.
One last bit is, earlier tonight, Brendan and I watched the deleted scenes, which apparently Lee had already seen, and...
ages ago, yeah.
And
you were telling me, like, oh, we're going to watch these, and I was like, oh, I don't need to see them.
Well, the way that Jojen Reed...
described them, and I was like, I've seen all of these.
The way that Jojen Reed gets Joanna in the airport
well,
in that original cut...
Well, okay, so a prefix to that. Initially, in the earlier drafts of the script, we see that Jojen Reed is a gymnast, and you apparently are supposed to see him like at like doing gymnastics, but not really being into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so later in the movie, during the airport chase scene, instead of just leaping through the metal detector, he does a like double backflip through the metal detector, and then instead of running through a waiting area, he does like somersaults through a fucking waiting area. And then as the police, like as like the travel agency is like cornering him, he like looks over a balcony where Joanna is getting into the plane below him. He jumps up, grabs a hold of a bar, and like does an entire fucking bar routine to swing down like fucking Kelly in The Lost World with the Velociraptors. It is bullshit.
I forgot about that.
Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit.
We laughed so
yeah,
like,
I
both
say,
times.
I laughed harder at that sequence than I did at anything else in this movie.
It was wild.
Weird, wild stuff.
Weird, wild stuff.
Weird,
wild
stuff.
Who wants to start with their fix?
I'll fucking have a go at it.
All right.
Have a go at it.
It is Christmas, and we do tell the truth on Christmas, right?
We tell the truth on Christmas. Right
do whatever
under,
is appropriate on
right under a Christmas tree.
Oh.
What I'm going to pitch is an anthology love movie that I could write about Christmas right now. So here's... I like anthology things, and I like having... I like the general structure of sort of bouncing between stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, on my own time, come up with my own anthology love story. So I'm just going to Christmas-fy some of that, and
Let's
I'll take in some of the stuff that I like. Mine was that I'm more fascinated with, unlike this movie where things happen in, like, an absurdly short amount of time.
In a month.
Yeah, wow. I'm fascinated with, this is why I, like, generally like TV shows a lot, but I find it hard to, the attention span of TV shows, I find it hard to sit through, especially the longer ones, but I'm fascinated that they can show relationships develop over years,
mm-hmm.
and not just, like, a whirlwind weekend. And so what I would do, what I've developed of way different ways of doing for my own stories, is I would have it be set over the course of maybe 3 to 6 Christmases. So like a 3 to 6 year thing. And we cover, you know, some of these stories I might take on. But what I would love to see is like vignettes from each year. And maybe you get a few that are outside of it because it might be hard to do like just purely seasonally. But I'd love to take some of these stories and troll them out. Like, maybe Jeremy and Aurelia, maybe he goes there every summer. Mm-hmm. I'd rather, sorry, every, like, Christmas to, like, mm-hmm. do a retreat. And every time he comes back and he understands a little bit more, like, Portuguese or whatever, maybe you can see this, like, relationship between father and son with Daniel and Sam, like, evolving over time. Like, the first one is right after the funeral, and then it's a year later, and then 2 years later. And so forth. And every time it gets a little bit less awkward and they're a little bit more like a father and son. You could see Billy Mack maybe like start off not quite in the drain, and then he goes in the drain and then he comes back out of the drain. So maybe he starts off when he's still, because yeah, by the way, you're not obligated to show a scene from every year. It's not like if we show Billy Mack when he's a hot young thing in the 70s, we have to then show everyone. No, you don't. You can
right,
just
right.
like cut to like the next scene of him is like when you're catching up with everyone else in 95.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you can see that he's hit rock bottom, but his manager, who he like was ignoring for the first time when he was a hot young thing, is now his only friend. But he's, you know, he's like, because that's all he has left. So yeah, that's what I would like. And I would love, I would actually think I would love to see the unrequited love thing over a long period of time.
Yeah.
That's my pitch. I would love to see that. That's what I would like to see in a movie, is just like vignettes over the course of 3 to 6 years.
I have a similar idea in that I would like this to be a miniseries that is also over the span of 3 Christmases. There is a time jump element that I think may create some of the same problems that we see in this movie, but I think there's a way to get around it, and it's by each installment to be a decent amount of time, you know, 2 or 3 hours to really get into things repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
I trim out some things. As much as I like the Prime Minister storyline, I'm getting rid of it. What I actually am kind of into, this idea of a lot of these relationships that are in crisis that I would like to see resolved more interestingly in on film. So I'm keeping Rickman and Thompson. I'm keeping the tortured love triangle. I'm keeping Firth and Aurelia. And then I think I'm also going to keep Carl and Sarah. I'm going to try to center things more. They like to do this whole interconnectivity thing, but it gets really loose at the seams and spools out into many directions. So my thought is Sarah's brother is in the group home where Rickman works and is where he spends a lot of time with another physician who would be Mia, and Mia will actually be a full character. The two of them have a very close working relationship that turns romantic. This is noticed by Thompson, who struggles to deal with it. I would like to maybe put some time into understanding and kind of driving forward how an affair like this would happen and not just because, like it does in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a way that you can resolve that situation semi-cathartically, but I think the best and most emotionally realistic thing I would put forth would be they come to a place where they're maybe working on it, but you're not entirely sure they're going to stay together. They have a lot more room to go, but they've gotten someplace better after the revelation of the affair. Carl is also working at the group home, and that's where Sarah meets him. Mostly, I would keep the Colin Firth and Aurelia plot pretty much the same. It needs more space. Actually, have them have
time. You've got every plot line that takes place in the same group home except for Jamie and Aurelia.
Which I'm going to explain now.
Okay, sure, go ahead.
So, while I was away in New York, I read Tender is the Night, which was written by F. Scott Fitzgerald while his wife was in a group home, actually, Shepherd Pratt down in Baltimore. And I thought that would have been a really interesting idea. He is still, through some quirk, legally responsible for his ex-wife, who has been committed to this group home but did cheat on him before, so their marriage is dissolved. Geez,
that's bleak as fuck. I'm sorry. Just the
this, like, this is the producer speaking. Yeah. Your movie sounds like a real fucking bummer.
I gotta say, no, I'm sorry. Like, I don't mean to really interject, but just the fact, like, one, she's his ex-wife. Two, before she went crazy, she had an affair. And three, she's legally responsible for his cheating crazy ex-wife.
It's not necessarily crazy. My thought was just that the affair was maybe born out of a kind of, like, a long depression-related desperation.
Oh, God, okay.
And I realize as I'm saying it out loud.
And what, Aurelia's looking orderly?
No, Aurelia, he's staying nearby, and Aurelia is just, I mean, it's sort of the same deal. It's an Airbnb kind of situation.
And then at the end, we pull out on baby Jojo Reed with a snow globe.
Yeah, really. The love triangle, similarly, my thought was, again, to give Juliet something to do. She also works at the group home, but she has a husband, Peter's best friend, Mark.
I'm gonna watch a Christmas movie. In a group home.
I mean, I realized as I was writing this, this was Christmas on the surface.
I was like, it seems like you took the bleakest parts of Love Actually and amplified them up to 10.
Well, but my thought was, you can take it to a really bleak place, but you can still resolve these things, and that you can still give them
endings
that feel earned.
But something has to be happy about Christmas movies.
I guess. I don't know. I guess what I saw was Henry.
On an unrelated note, Lee, I cut my hair off and bought you this watch. And Lee got me a gift card.
I guess I'm realizing now I have all my plot lines. I have my.
She got it 5 years ago for Christmas and hasn't used it.
There you go.
Yeah, I guess I made the saddest Christmas movie ever made.
It's really sad. It sounds like everyone just sort of ends in a place of like. So, well, I guess our lives are irrevocably changed, and not necessarily for the better.
No, further Aurelia gets together, he's able to heal.
Okay, good.
All right, well, one person comes out on top.
Good for Jamie.
Well, and well, we see Rickman and Thompson mostly bounce back from the...
Chris, you have something you want to talk about? I don't know how much time it was stressful. Really stressed myself.
Oh my god, I'm crying.
Yeah, I was really blown away by it.
I was like taking notes on this, and I think in my head I was like, wow, this is compelling drama.
That's so a Christmas movie.
Oh god. Merry Christmas, everyone. Brendan, do you
remember how I saw this?
No, I brought the room down, so you can now bring it back up.
Great, there's nowhere else to go, I guess.
Oh, fuck me. I mean, it was good stuff.
No, it was. Like, I don't know why this was terrible. It was just like, it kept, I was thinking like some like frothy, frivolous Christmas thing, and it kept getting bleaker and bleaker and bleaker.
Sad.
And that's fine.
No, but it's maybe not a Christmas movie. It's what it was.
All right.
Oh my god. Holy, no, I don't think it, anyway, God.
Oh, Christ.
Oh, that's so
what
good.
Was so funny is this all was working in my head, and I spoke it out loud, and I was kind of having experience with you guys of like, oh, we're going to just some dark, we're going to just some dark corners. Yeah. Oh my God.
All right.
Holy shit.
So I have two ideas here. The first one is the easy, like, cleanup idea. Like, if you just had this script, and how would you make this script better, you know, by doing some little tweaks?
Burn it?
Yeah. Set fire to it. Chase down Richard Curtis, get him with a bat.
Yeah.
The first thing I would do is I would want to minimize the interconnected stuff. It makes the universe more complicated and harder to follow. You're sitting there wondering, like, how these people know each other, why they're there mm-hmm. at this place, what's their backstory. There are some things that are good. Like, the one example that I really like of how the story is interplay is when you see... is when baby Jojen Reed is trying to run to catch Joanna, and like he's right outside the gates or wherever the plane is taking off. Yeah, the gate. And he's trying to get past like the three ticket people, and then all of a sudden you see Billy Mack on TV stripping like he said he was going to do earlier on, and they all like look away and they're just looking at that and laughing so he can sneak by.
That's the one example you're like.
That is the one example where I'm like, oh, the interconnectedness actually works. It's like, yeah. It's like unexpected ways.
Well, it pays off in a way that at least feels organic and not forced.
Yeah, it's like earned and not just like, it would be weird if Billy Mack just like showed up at the airport and was like, hey, look at me everyone, I'm Billy Mack, and then like George and Reed ran
because,
by.
But
because that moment both makes sense for Billy Mack and it's also needed.
I like some but not all of the I think that was one thing Salome used to do a little bit more eloquently was the interconnectedness.
I think there are some parts that work well.
I enjoy it, but I do think it's done badly.
You need like a fucking, like we said earlier, we don't know exactly how Emma Thompson and Liam Neeson know each other. We're like, are they friends? Are they exes? Like, were they siblings? We don't know.
I think they're friends.
I think they are too, but Lee said they were siblings, and I can see why you would say they were siblings. Yeah. Like, there's no information.
The problem is, some stuff is show, don't tell, and that stuff I need told. Other things are told.
They're so overt. Like, she literally says, like, I've never been happier to see you, big brother, whenever Emma Thompson, like, hugs them. Like, okay, like, I get it.
She even hangs up the phone with him and then turns to, I guess, Alan Rickman and is like, of all the times for my prime minister brother to call.
It's just like, it's so obvious. And there are other ones that do not get any
attention.
That's
a younger brother too, right?
She says big brother. I thought she was older than him too.
Incorrect.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like there's the same range.
Yeah, I think that's very close. Cut the fucking president bullshit plot. The movie doesn't care about politics, neither do we. You can focus entirely on his relationship with Natalie, who also has a degree in geopolitical studies in this version, and she got a job as his assistant to help her get up in this world. She regularly assists him with work, but he's more concerned about bringing her into the public eye, what it would look like, him being like a new prime minister, that sort of shit. In the end, she says he might as well like drag her into the public eye with him, because she's probably going to run for PM in a few years anyway, and then she's just going to drag him back into it if he doesn't do it first. Liam Neeson's plot stays largely the same, but his wife has been dead for 1 year. He's coming up on the 1 year anniversary of her death, and he's still doubting his ability to be a good father. You include some of the sweet bonding shit, like in the deleted scenes. It's some good stuff in the deleted scenes with them.
It really is, actually. You see some chemistry that was much needed in this movie.
Colin Firth and Aurelia both speak a little bit of English enough to connect without being totally oblivious to what the other one is saying. At the end, they both meet at Heathrow Airport, where he is going to find her, but he realizes that she has just got there moments before he did to try and find him, instead of doing the thing where like he shows up in little Portugal and drags the entire village with him, because I think it puts them on a little more equal footing at that point. Emma Thompson's storyline focuses more on her role in life. Her brother is the PM, and she's just a housewife and a mother, and she's feeling sort of depressed about that. She's in charge of the children's Christmas nativity play at the school, which she thinks is kind of unfulfilling. She thinks Alan Rickman might be unfaithful, but she doesn't really have any proof of this. In the end, it turns out he was acting all weird because he was going to surprise her with a holiday. Maybe in the end, she resolves to work with the school in drama productions because she finds it fulfilling, and she helps Liam Neeson give the pep talk to little stepson, little baby George and Reed at the end, too.
Goddamn, does she deserve a holiday.
Yeah, and she just deserves to, like, have something to do, right? Mm-hmm. She deserves purpose in life. That was her biggest thing for me.
That's a good angle for that character.
That's
to feel
really
like,
good.
Yeah.
Well, to feel like she has...
already infidelity. It's really bad.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't need it.
But that also that she has all of this, like, energy and skill and talent, but that she feels like it's just going...
Right, because I can't remember who here said that there's a focus more on the idea that, like, she feels bad about herself, ergo that's why she's saying all these things, and I think that's more interesting. Like,
yeah.
She feels depressed because she has this such negative image of herself, and maybe she needs to learn how to, like, you know... find something different in her life.
And love herself.
Laura Linney is going to stay mostly the same, except in the end she runs into Andrew Lincoln at the airport. They have a brief moment of recognition from the thing at the beginning and hints at a possible romantic future.
I like that.
Andrew Lincoln is in love with Keira Knightley, who isn't married yet. She finds out when she point blank asks him why he's so cold and standoffish to her and figures out why. He says he's not going to make a reduction of it or anything, and this is just something he's going to have to work his way through. In the end, we see him appreciating the love he has for Keira and we see him appreciating the love that Keira and Chiwetel have for each other before he has his Laura Linney moment. So it's more he celebrates the fact that, like, they love each other and this is a good thing for them. And, like, he loves them both. So, you know, it's not working out for him ideally, but there will be other things that work out for him. And then Laura Linney pops in.
What if it's a grand gesture for them?
That could be cute.
Oh, that would be really sweet.
Like, he did at the wedding, but, not at the wedding.
Yeah, that could work.
That would actually be a great callback.
And the movie makes it look like he's going to try to woo Keira Knightley.
Yeah.
But it's really just to get the two of them together.
Like, No, that's cute.
That is
like
super
that,
cute.
I'll take that note.
And then he walks off into the night.
Could you take that back to set?
Wraps his cape around himself.
Yeah. Could you take that back to set with you? Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Billy Mack stays the same. I got no issue with that. I'm going to either cut Colin or have his plane crash somewhere in Canada where his fellow passengers have to eat him to survive. Or
jeez.
Maybe he gets stranded on a desert island with Mia.
Hashtag savage.
The other option that I had, and this is a real quick sketch, So I know we all joke, we joke about the fact that, like, one of the first lines is Hugh Grant being like, whenever I feel sad, I look at the airport and I'm happy again. And it's just sort of like, it's one of those lines of like, yeah, it's a stupid thing to say because people associate airports with, like, stress and security and lines and all this bullshit. But, like, I get what he's saying in terms of, like, you see people, like, reconnecting and, like, you see families getting back together. And I like that. So what I had thought is maybe the entire movie takes place in an airport on Christmas Eve. And you have...
Sorry, this is a running joke on Moonlighting, is where it? Bruce Willis's character pitches up one of his TV shows, where the first one is like, it's called Bus Station. And then there's one called, like, Train Station.
Well, it was called Wings, Lee, and it was dumb.
Yeah.
You have an older couple whose children have moved out, and they're worried that their relationship is going stale. You have a gay couple who's meeting one guy's parents for the first time for Christmas. A guy seeing a girlfriend, like, not a girlfriend, but, like, a girl who is a friend, who he was in love with, who got married recently. A single father and his stepson going to see his deceased wife's family and worrying about how his son is dealing with all of this. A pilot and the friendship he has with his crew who are all away from their families on Christmas Eve. Plots about the people who work in the shops and restaurants there, that sort of crap. It all takes place in or around Heathrow Airport. You can still incorporate some of the highlights of the movie, like the big events that you like. And you get things like, what I like in this movie is, you know, people working together who don't really know each other, helping someone to a gate quickly or to say goodbye to someone who's leaving on another flight. And you build these connections throughout the movie rather than throwing them out in the beginning and trying to hope that they're all there. Yeah. So, like, you get to see these people meet and interact and, you know, how their paths, like, intersect each other.
Legit question. Was Love Actually, because I don't know this for sure.
Yeah.
But was Love Actually the one to kind of kick off that kind of short trend of, like, holiday-based, everyone's connected movies?
I think it might have been in terms of it being a very big one to do that. Like, that's why we have, you know, Mother's Day and New Year's Eve and all that shit. Yeah.
Well, that was just Gary Marshall.
That was Gary Marshall, like, getting his jollies. But
that's the same concept, almost.
I mean, it's similar. I feel like Love Actually was what showed us that, like, you can cram a bunch of stars and a bunch of plots into a movie and, like, people will eat it up.
True.
Yeah.
In a weird way, Love Actually is almost a response to, like, the Towering Inferno and all those things. It's almost like a modern-day rom-com version of, like, throwing as many celebrities, like, in one situation.
Or like Grand Hotel.
Yeah.
Also, wasn't, I feel like Airport was another one.
Maybe? Yeah, I mean, it was mostly disaster movies in the 70s.
Right.
And before then, there were, like, a lot of comedies, like, in the 30s and 40s.
Mother's Day wasn't that, though, right? Because they couldn't get people to be in those movies.
No. I mean, at a certain point, like, New Year's Eve was, where it was just, like, whatever celebrity wandered
out of
the studio.
Valentine's Day was as well.
Yeah. Mother's Day was just, like, three women, I think, right? And, like, their husband. Like, it was, like, mostly three women and their stories. Going off of that, recommend it.
Here's the tricky thing about
it
is, you've seen it.
I know, right?
Well, honestly, if you're listening to it, you have probably seen it.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a dumb movie, but it's not a terrible movie. Like, there are aspects of it that are certainly bad.
Yeah.
But there are enjoyable things, too. Like, it really is, it's like a fucking fruitcake. Like, it's just, there's so much shit in here, and some of it's good, and some of it's bad.
Very true.
And you just have to sort of work your way through it all. I think it's worth watching once. And then it'll be up to you as to whether or not you feel it's something you need to revisit.
I agree. Yeah. I think it's not even a question of, like, enjoy it, don't enjoy it. It's something I think you should experience and form an opinion on.
Yeah.
Because for better or for worse, this is a flashpoint of cultural opinions.
It is.
I think everyone should watch it, but I'm not, you know, you should watch it with a critical eye.
Yeah, that's the big, also alcohol.
Like...
Yeah.
Or, like, I mean, a lot of times, like I kind of mentioned before I watched this one, it would be like, having a Christmas party, and we're all just kind of sitting here talking, but the movie's on.
Yeah.
I think we've kind of
recommendations.
Done this one.
Yeah. 2 weeks. We'll see you.
Yeah.
Bye is all around you guys.
It's PM while theme it out.
Bye, 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 bye.